Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And I mean that. It really is. It may not seem like the hammer or the shoe is going to drop right now. As a matter of fact, I understand the danger in being a Chicken Little, right? The sky is falling. However, to turn around, we cannot turn the ship around in, you know, one quick, easy move. This is going to require everybody's help. This is going to require all hands on deck. In other words, as more and more people are starting to realize that everything in one way or the other is a part of the problem, unless it is a part of the solution. And that's how easy it is to really, you know, divide everything down. Is this institution involved in the solution, or is this institution not involved in the solution, ergo it is a part of the problem? Is this person involved in the solution, or is this person not involved in the solution, ergo they are part of the problem? It's really that simple. And and so actually I took a lot of, you know, maybe not a lot of liberty, but I thought it would be helpful to prove how all of these different markets, you know, because we have all of these different markets. The entertainment industry is a market. And when we look at the entertainment industry, it's no different. It is no different than the news journalism industry. I mean, it's not really the press. That is not the press. We, the people, are the press. The individual reporters telling the story, taking the pictures, that is the press. They have basically grouped and gathered together groups of people that are the press into what we call platforms, whether they be, you know, online platform, whether they be an in-print platform, whether they be a video broadcasting platform. It doesn't really matter. It is a platform. You tune to their channel and they will feed you their scum. And so, I mean, I can't make it really much simpler than that. And so when we looked at how in the late 60s, I mean, show me a label that was promoting true liberty, free markets, and embracing the rule of law. I mean, they took on the obscure, you know, and not that our government wasn't violating, but technically, those people who were championed, standing up to, you know, what we called government, were actually seeking to violate the Constitution even more and to undermine our society. That's why, I mean, it was properly dubbed as the counterculture revolution. And did they win? Well, for a time, they gained lots of ground. Well, folks, that's what I'm saying. There's a lot of ground we've got to take back. But it's easy to do that, as I pointed out on Friday, with the truth, because there is one demographic that is ripe to seize the truth and just move forward and march with it. But we have to get it into their hands, because it's the youth that does that. I mean, look how stupid we were. Those of us who participated, I being one. I mean, I grew up in that time frame. And, you know, it was great. You know, the fruit that came from that, even though it was temporary and carnal, the fruit that came from that was very, I'll just say, addictive. It was very alluring. And it's just like power. It's just like all of these different things. And so anyway, so as I was looking and as I was contemplating on, you know, my show this weekend, I was really looking and saying, you know, by the time I am done with this year, I think I will have completed at least a full version of one topic or another in going through the documents that address those types of topics. In other words, I think I've given you enough information that you should be able to do this. Why aren't you doing this? There's only a few things I really haven't covered. There's a, you know, what we're covering right now in Madison's notes on the convention is kind of helping you understand that it wasn't 13 states. It wasn't even 11 states that said, oh, you know, we got to keep slavery. Actually, we're seeing that it really was only 3 states. The rest of the states, and, you know, Delaware was back and forth, and maybe Maryland, you know, a little bit, but, you know, Virginia was pretty straightforward. They weren't there to actually perpetuate slavery in the Union. They were willing to let it go, regardless of how far entrenched Virginia was. And, you know, not even thinking, because I'm telling you, when you really look at the ratification debates, there may have been a very good, I'll just say a good likelihood that Virginia would not have ratified the Constitution due to the fact that it was not going to preserve slavery. Because there were that many people that probably went to the convention that were pretty concerned over that slavery issue. But I believe that the whole point at that point in time was that they needed to do it right. And I think that they were really doing it right. And I honestly believe, even though there may not have been a lot of people, I still think that the Lord would have inspired those conventions to cross that finish line to get this Constitution ratified. And I think that there was some compromises that went into it that didn't necessarily make them happy. We're going to get to that when we get to August 22nd, the infamous day, or I should say that famous day, where George Mason basically, I'll just say, puts a hex on this nation and this republic for maintaining slavery. So now we're dealing with Mr. Pinckney of South Carolina. He's the next up speaking, and he's speaking regarding property. And basically, Mr. Pinckney stated this, that the committee, as he had conceived, were instructed to report the proper qualifications of property for the members of the national legislature, instead of which they had referred to the task to the national legislature itself. In other words, what he's pointing out is, you know, we needed to set that standard in this Constitution instead of deferring it to those Johnny come, you know, lately on the spot in that very first session, because you have no control over what they're going to do. And he makes this lucid point. And got to remember, he was an advocate for slavery. I mean, he was constantly trying to ensure that they maintained an upper hand, because that's what it was all about. And the majority of the mass money in America in the control of a few people was in the South. And so anyway, he says this, should it be left on this footing, the first legislature will meet without any particular qualifications of property. And if it should happen to consist of rich men, they might fix such qualifications as may be too favorable to the rich. If of poor men, an opposite extreme might be run into. He was opposed to the establishment of an undue aristocratic influence in the constitutions, but he thought it essential that the members of the legislature, the executive, and the judges should be possessed of competent property to make them independent and respectable. It was prudent when such great powers were to be trusted to connect the tie of property with that reputation in securing a faithful administration. the, you know, because you got to understand, as they, these men understood that the whole point of government was to protect these two things, to protect life and individual property. And so if a person didn't have property, they would not have the, you know, the compulsion, or they would not have the desire to worry about, you know, defending other people's property because they weren't possessing any. Anyway, the president would also have great influence on it. The judges would have not only important causes between citizens and citizens, but also where foreigners are concerned. They will even be umpires between the states and the individual states, as well as, and see, this is right here is where we get that real view that they're not to be judges, they are to be umpires, okay? So, I mean, it's really important to highlight, and I say that because when we look at the Commerce Clause, many people think that the government can regulate the states regarding commerce. No, their job was to be the umpires to make sure that, you know, everything was done fairly and on the up and up, that no state could create advantages over others. Anyway, were he to fix the quantum of property which would be required, he should not think of less than $100,000 for the president, half of that sum for each of the judges, and in like proportion of the members of the national legislature. He would, however, leave the sums blank. His motion was that the president of the U.S., the judges, and members of the legislature should be required to swear that there were respectively processed of a cleared, unencumbered estate to the amount of blank, 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 blank in the case of the president, et cetera, and et cetera. In other words, this was going to be a new qualification that never made it into the Constitution. So some people think that, oh, well, the Constitution requires an educated man. The Constitution requires a man of affluence or what have you. No, this is how AOC, a penniless bartender, became a congressperson. And she has been using and misusing her position and violating her oath of office every day she's been in, because she thinks she can, because we allow it to happen. And until we start demanding compliance to the Constitution, people like her are going to continue to flaunt their arrogance and their disregard for the law. Anyway, Mr. Rutledge of South Carolina then pipes in and he says, and seconded the motion, observing that the committee had reported no qualifications because they could not agree on any among themselves, being embarrassed by the danger on one side of displeasing the people by making them high, and on the other, rendering them nugatory by making them low. Mr. Ellsworth, who became the Anti-Federalist up in Connecticut. The different circumstances of different paths of the U.S. and the probable difference between the present and the future circumstances of the whole render it improper improper to have other uniform or fixed qualifications, make them so high as to be useful in the southern states, and they will be impracticable in the eastern states. Suit them the latter, and they will serve no purpose in the former. In like manner, what may be accommodated to the existing states of things among us may be very inconvenient in some future states of them. He thought for these reasons that it was better to leave this matter on the legislative discretion than to attempt a provision for it in the Constitution. Now, Dr. Franklin then speaks up, and he expressed his dislike of everything that tended to debase the spirit of the common people. Ah, the wisdom of the sage speaks up, right? And so he goes on and says, if honesty was often the companion of wealth, and if property was exposed to peculiar temptation, it was not less true that the possession of property increased the desire of more property. Some of the greatest rogues he was ever acquainted with were the richest rogues. We would remember the character which the Scripture requires in rulers, that they should be men hating covetousness. This constitution will be much read and attended to in Europe, and if it should be betrayed a great partiality to the rich, will not only hurt us in the esteem of the most liberal and enlightened men there, but discourage the common people from removing into this country. He says removing, but he means by moving into this country. So the motion of Mr. Pinckney was rejected by so general, and no, the states were not called. Mr. Madison of Virginia was opposed to the section of vesting an improper and dangerous power in the legislature. The qualifications of electors and elected were fundamental articles in a Republican government and ought to be fixed by the Constitution. If the legislature could regulate those of either, it can by degree subvert the Constitution. A republic may be converted into an aristocracy or an oligarchy, as well as by limiting the number capable of being elected as the number authorized to elect. In all cases where the representatives of the people will have a personal interest distinct from that of their constituents, there was the same reason for being jealous of them as there was for relying on them with full confidence when they had a common interest. Okay, so just to put that all together, as was for relying on them with full confidence when they had a common interest. This was one of the former cases. It was as improper as to allow them to fix their own wages or their own privileges. It was a power also which might be made subservient to the views of one faction against another qualification, founded on artificial distinctions which may be devised by the stronger in order to keep out partisans of a weaker faction. Now, again, Mr. Ellsworth now pipes in, because Mr. Ellsworth he says, admitted that the power was not unexceptionable, but he could not view it as dangerous. Such a power with regard to the electors would be dangerous because it would be much more liable to abuse. Mr. Governor Morris moved to strike out with regard to property in order to leave the legislature entirely at large. Mr. Williams stated this should surely never be admitted. Should a majority of the legislature be composed of any particular description of men, of lawyers, for example, which is no improbable supposition, the future elections might be secured to their own body. Mr. Madison observed that the British Parliament possessed the power of regulating the qualifications of both the electors and the elected, and the abuse they have made of it was a lesson worthy of our attention. They had made changes in both cases subservient to their own views or to the views of their political religious parties. And that right there is, as far as I'm concerned, a very good insight as to, you know, why, one, they wanted to make sure that there was no control for those who were elected to be able to start creating what we'll call gate guards to ensure that only those who would be favorable, just as Madison stated, just only those who would have favor, like lawyers and what have you, to bring them in. And folks, we're seeing this. Why is it that the majority of the people that are going into office are lawyers? I mean, this is not a coincidence. So anyway, the question on the motion to strike out with regard to property, New Hampshire was no. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, aye, or yay. New Jersey, yay. Pennsylvania, yay. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, no. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, no. And Georgia, yay. So it was literally 7-4 based on the voting states. Now, it's, you know, kind of interesting. So I'm kind of extra highlighting this because I think Mr. Williamson made a very good salient point. And so as we head down and we get closer and closer to August 22nd, I'm looking for the next topic that's going to jump out here, which are patents. The first time, now I'm pointing this out because this is the first time, because you've heard me talking about this, patents were actually first time they were discussed or even mentioned. And so Mr. Madison submitted in order to be, and this actually, this is August 18th, right? So we've got a ways to go. And so what Mr. Madison talks about patents, and then we're going to dive into on the same day by Madison. It's all, this is also by Madison. Actually, no, but this will be by Mr. Mason. We'll be starting to talk about the militia. And so Mr. Madison submitted, in order to be referred to the Committee of Detail, the following powers as proper to be added to those of the General Legislature, quote, to dispose of the unappropriated lands of the United States, close quote, to institute temporary governments for new states arising therein. Now, what he's talking about is Article 4, Section 3, both of these lines. To regulate affairs with the Indians as well as within the limits of the United States. Quote, to exercise exclusive legislative authority at the seat of the general government and over a district around the same not exceeding blank square miles. The consent of the legislature of the state or states comprising the same being first obtained. To quote, grant charters of incorporation in cases where the public may require them and the authority of a single state may be incompetent. Now, I have to point out, folks, they are actually talking about giving the federal government the ability to create charters of incorporation. Did that actually make it into the Constitution? And I'm stating this because when we look at the, help me out here, when we look at the Constitution, there's no mention of incorporations or corporations. None. They have no ability to create or regulate them. This was left to the states. Now, it doesn't mean that they didn't talk about it, but by the divine hand of providence, it was left out. And it didn't become, you know, it didn't resurrect itself until the British overrun of money and politics in America in the 1870 election, where in 1871, they granted them to themselves this ability to create charters and so forth. Their exclusive legislation only extended to what they needed to do. It didn't give them exclusive legislation to amend the Constitution. It was strictly over the like manner of property of how to police and regulate the property itself. That was the whole point of that. And that's how it was defined. When we've gone through the ratification debates on exclusive legislation, it was never to extend, you know, like this boomerang, oh, well, we're going to do it here and we're going to apply it to the United States. No. And as a matter of fact, for a couple centuries, this idea prevailed even in court cases. You know, so in other words, the courts actually got it right, believe it or not. You know, in spite of some of the things that the court has done, they actually got it right in some of these cases. But anyway, when we come back, we'll finish what Mr. Madison is looking to include, and the copyrights is the next thing he's going to include. So we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so moving on, and so I wanted to highlight this one point. To grant charters of incorporation in cases where the public good may require them, and the authority of a single state may be competent. So in other words, so they wanted to use charters. Now, let's think about this. If we looked at the charters that were created by England, that was created by the king. Which means that he controlled, because look up a charter, folks. A charter is when a sovereign grants the existence of something. And this was removed. Now, I guess what I need to do is I need to actually go into, because the whole point of what I'm doing right now is actually looking in the constitutional notes or the notes on the Constitutional Convention for these very specific topics like patents. I believe the word patent, I'm going to do it real quick here because we're going to come into them as far as patents and copyrights and so forth. I believe that when we look at for patent or what have you, you're only going to find it like four times and then copyrights for a limited time. So anyway, this is what it says, quote, this is Madison again, to secure to literary authors their copyright for a limited time, to establish a university, giving the federal government the ability to establish universities would give them the ability to regulate education. Did they give them this power in the Constitution? No. To encourage by premium provisions the advancements of useful knowledge and discoveries, to authorize the executive to procure and hold for the use of the United States landed property for the erection of forts, magazines, and necessary buildings. Now, later on, this was changed to where the executive didn't have to procure this, but it was required that Congress procure it. In other words, in that same subparagraph of Section 8, where the exclusive authority over the District of Columbia is granted, likewise authority is over those areas procured by the state from the state legislatures by the federal government for the erection of forts, magazines, and other needful buildings. Okay, so to be clear, what he was looking for here was, you know, a little bit more that the executive would have that. That all got shook out, that only Congress had powers. That the powers delegated, the only quasi-power that the president had was quasi-power, was the ability to bring forth treaties and the ability to veto legislation. So that was a negative power when you look at it. These propositions were referred to the Committee of Detail, which they had prepared the report, and at the same time, the following which were moved by Mr. Pinckney, in both cases unanimously. Quote, to fix permanently, establish the seat of government in the United States, in which they shall possess the exclusive right of soil and jurisdiction. This was the first time that they ever came up with the exclusive right of soil. In other words, in the Constitution, the federal government was never granted the authority over the exclusive right of soil. That language was removed. It is not enumerated. So why is it that there are these things called mineral rights to every stitch of land of the United States? It's because of tyranny. The establishment to establish seminaries for the promotion of literature and the arts of science, to grant charters of incorporation, to grant patents for useful inventions, to secure to authors exclusive rights for a certain time, to establish public institutions, reward and immunities for the promotion of agriculture, commerce, trades, and manufactures. Quote, the funds that shall be appropriated for payment of public creditors shall not, during the time of such appropriation, be diverted or applied to any other purpose, and that the committee prepare a clause or clauses for restraining the legislature of the United States from establishing a perpetual revenue. Okay, so that was something that they were going to include so that they could not create a perpetual form of revenue, something like income tax, but eventually, or excise tax, right? Something that this became with this perpetual, I mean, the excise tax on liquor, tobacco, and those types of things, that's perpetual. So this concept of creating perpetual revenue, you know, which is what basically started feeding the lust of government for spending on many other things that they had no, well, we got the money to secure the payment of the public debt, to secure all creditors under the new Constitution from a violation of the public faith when pledged by the authority of the legislature, to grant letters of marque and reprisal, to regulate stages on the post roads. In other words, to actually regulate vehicles on post roads. Now, this is where they bring in and they kind of turn the focus onto the militia. Mr. Mason introduced the subject of regulating the militia. He thought such a power necessary to be given to the general government. He hoped there would be no standing army in time of peace, unless it might be for a few garrisons. And that was it, right? The militia ought therefore to be the more effectually prepared for the public defense. 13 states will never concur in any one system. If the disciplining of the militia be left in their hands, if they will not give up the power over the whole, they probably will over a part as a select militia. He moved, as an addition to the propositions just referred to the committee of detail, and to be referred in like manner to a power to regulate the militia. Mr. Gary remarked, now this is Mr. Gary, the anti-federalist in Massachusetts, remarked that some provisions ought to be made in favor of public securities, and something inserted concerning letters of marque, which he thought not included in the power of war. He proposed that these subjects should go to a committee. Mr. Rutledge moved to refer a clause, quote, that funds appropriated to public creditors should not be diverted to other purposes, close quote. Mr. Mason was much attached to the principle, but was afraid such a fetter might be dangerous in time of war. He suggested the necessity of preventing the danger of perpetual revenue, which must be of necessity subvert the liberty of any country. If it be objected to on the principle of Mr. Rutledge's motion that the public credit may require perpetual provisions, that case may be expected no excepted, it being declared in other cases, no tax should be laid for longer term than blank years. He considered the caution observed in Great Britain on this point as the palladium of the public liberty. Now, when we look at creating these types of limitations, the only true limitation that they had actually went upon the militia, where the militia was only granted, or the army. Let me clarify this. The militia is to be maintained, period, always, and it's to be maintained in the hands of the states. When necessary, the federal government will federalize the militia to create an army. That is how the army is formed, is by federalizing the militia. They are not to have a standing army or anything greater than, or funding greater than, 2 years. They did that to keep the federal government from being able to actually rain tyranny upon the states by having a perpetual ability to just grab their federalized militia to execute laws of the Union when they had to actually call for the militia to do that. If they called for the militia to deal with an invasion like we've got going on today, then they would need to also call to the states up for more of the militia for a separate reason, such as dealing with the execution of the laws or an insurrection here or there. The enumeration of why they call forth and have the power to call forth the militia is critical. They don't have the ability to basically call it forth to do, you know, a variety of things. Only those three things: executing the laws, suppressing insurrections, and repelling invasions. That simple. Now, the next one, and it brings up again the militia on the same day. And so what day are we on? I think I covered this. Yep, Saturday, the 18th of August. So Mr. Gary took notice that there was no check here against standing armies in time of peace. The existing Congress is so constructed that it cannot of itself maintain an army. This would not be the case under the new system. The people were jealous of this head, and great opposition to the plan would spring from such an omission. He suspected that preparations of force were now making against it. He seemed to allude to the activity of the governor of New York at this crisis in disciplining the militia of the state. He thought an army dangerous in time of peace and could never consent to a power to keep up an indefinite number. He proposed that there shall not be kept up in time of peace more than 1,000 troops. His idea was that the blank should be filled with 2,000 or 3,000 instead of, quote, build and equip fleets, close quote, to provide and maintain a navy. And everybody agreed on that without any reservations or without any dissent. In other words, when he put it out there that, okay, we need to separate this, we also need to build, and instead of building and equipping fleets, to provide and maintain a navy, everybody agreed. To make rules for the government and regulations of the land and naval forces. In other words, they're to create the governing of these military bodies as they form the permanent navy and as they maintain and manage the standards, not manage the militia, but the standards of the militia. Anyway, Mr. L. Martin and Mr. Gary now regularly moved, quote, to provide that in time of peace, the army shall not consist of more than 1,000 men. And it's just 1,000. It should say 8,000, 1,000, but anyway, 1,000 men. General Pinckney asked whether no troops were ever to be raised until an attack should be made on us. Mr. Gary, if there be no restriction, a few states may establish a military government. Mr. Williamson reminded of Mr. Mason's motion for limiting the appropriations of revenue as the best guard in this case. Mr. Langdon saw no room for Mr. Gary's distrust of representatives of the people. They're going back and forth. This is obviously a very heated issue. Mr. Dayton, preparations for war are generally made in peace, and a standing force of some sort may, for aught we know, become unavoidable. He should object to no restrictions consistent with these ideas. The motion of Mr. Martin and Mr. Gary was disagreed without contest. So, in other words, they didn't follow those. Mr. Mason moved as an additional power, quote, to make laws for the regulation and discipline of the militia of the several states, reserving to the states the appointment of officers, close quote. He considered uniformity as necessary in the regulation of the militia throughout the Union. General Pinckney mentioned a case during the war in which a dissimilarity in the militia of different states had produced much serious mischiefs. Uniformity was essential. The states would never keep up a proper discipline of their militia. Mr. Ellsworth was for going as far in submitting the militia to the general government as might be necessary, but thought the motion of Mr. Mason went too far. He moved that the militia should have the same arms and exercise and be under the rules established by the general government when in actual service of the United States, and when states neglect to provide regulations for militia, it should be regulated and established by the legislature of the United States. The whole authority over the militia ought by no means be taken away from the states, whose consequence would pine away to nothing after such a sacrifice of power. He thought the general authority could not sufficiently pervade the Union for such a purpose, nor could it accommodate itself to the local genius of the people. It must be vain to ask the states to give the militia out of their hands. Mr. Sherman seconded the motion. Mr. Dickinson, we are now to come to the most important matter, that of the sword. The option was that the states never would nor ought to give up all authority over the militia. He proposed to restrain the general government to 1/4 part of the time, which by rotation would discipline the whole militia. Mr. Butler urged the necessity of submitting the whole militia. I mean, they're all over the map. You see this, folks? They're all bringing up their own little pet peeves, right? Mr. Butler urged the necessity of submitting the whole militia to the general authority, which had the care of general defense. Mr. Mason had suggested the idea of a select militia. He was led to think that would be, in fact, as much as the general government could advantageously be charged with. He was afraid of creating insuperable objects to the plan. He withdrew his original motion and moved a power, quote, to make laws for regulating and disciplining the militia not exceeding 1/10 in any one year and reserving the appointment of officers to the states, close quote. Mr. Pinckney renewed Mr. Mason's original motion for a part to be under the general and part under the state governments would be an incurable evil. He saw no room for such distrust of the general government. Now, Mr. Langdon seconded General Pinckney's renewal. He saw no more reason to be afraid of the general government than that of the state governments. He was more apprehensive of the confusion of the different authorities on this subject than of either. Now, Mr. Madison, this is the first time I think Madison is piped in. And Mr. Madison thought the regulation of the militia naturally appertaining to the authority charged with the public defense. It did not seem in its nature to be divisible between two distinct authorities. If the states would trust the general government with a power over the public treasurer, they would, from the same consideration of necessity, grant it the direction of the public force. Those who had a full view of the public situation would, from a sense of danger, guard against it. The states would not be separately impressed with the general situation, nor have the due confidence in the concurrent exertions of each other. Mr. Ellsworth now considered the idea of a select militia as impracticable, and if it would not, it would be followed by a ruinous declension of the great body. D-E-C-L-E-N-S-I-O-N. Never heard of that one before, and there's no synonym for it in the book. But anyway, the states will never submit to the same militia laws. 3 or 4 shillings as a penalty will enforce obedience better in New England than 40 lashes in some other places. Mr. Pinckney thought the power such as one as could not be abused, and that the states would see the necessity of surrendering it. He had, however, but a scanty faith in the militia. There must also be a real military force, which was the Navy, to be maintained. You got to remember that the whole point of the militia was to actually fight wars of invasions, not to send abroad. They had no plan of, you know, basically quartering men on ships to send into foreign lands to fight a war on foreign soil. The only reason we had a Navy and Marines was to defend us abroad and our interest of commerce and treaties and so forth. Anyway, this alone can, back to Mr. Pinckney, this alone can effectually answer the purpose. The United States had been making an experiment without it, and we can see the consequences in their rapid approaches towards anarchy. Mr. Sherman took notice that the states might want their militia for defense against invasions and insurrections, for enforcing obedience to their laws. There it is right there. There are the three primers for the federal government to call forth the militia. Anyway, Mr. Sherman goes on and says, they will not give up this point. In giving up that of taxation, they retain a concurrent power of raising money for their own use. So they're not just going to give up their army. They're going to want to have these natural defenses against invasions, insurrections, and enforcing the law. Mr. Gary, and got to remember, folks, they did not have mercenary police forces. In other words, professional police forces where, you know, you basically occupied these positions. Everybody had a responsibility. And when we go through the ratification debates, you'll find that if you're to serve in the militia and you're called up and you can't go, or you're not willing or conscientiously objecting, you have to pay the salary of the person that replaces you. That simple. I mean, in other words, that's how serious this obligation was. So Mr. Gary thought that this last point remaining to be surrendered, if it be argued by the convention, the plan will have as a black mark as it was set on Kane. He had no such confidence in the general government as some gentlemen professed, and believed that it would be found that the states have not. Now, Colonel Mason thought that there was great weight in the remarks of Mr. Sherman, and moved an exception to his motion, quote, of such part of the militia as may be required by the states for their own use, close quote. Mr. Reed doubted the propriety of leaving the appointment of the militia officers in the states. In some states, they are elected by the legislatures, in others by the people themselves. He thought at least an appointment by the state executives ought to be insisted upon. On committing to the Grand Committee, last appointed, the latter motion of Colonel Mason and the original one revived by General Pinckney. New Hampshire, yes. Massachusetts, yes. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, yes. Maryland divided, so no vote. Virginia, yes. North Carolina, yes. South Carolina, yes. And Georgia, yes. And it was overwhelming, 8-2. There you go. And so as they perused on, we pass August 20th, and we come upon August 21st. So in other words, the 20th, they may have had ancillary conversations regarding the militia and so forth, but they kick it off on August 20th with the militia again. First thing, right out the gate, and Governor Livingston, from the Committee of 11, to whom was referred the proposition respecting the debts of the several states and also the militia, entered on the 18th, instructed, delivered by the following report, and this is their report, quote, "The legislature of the United States shall have power to fulfill the engagements which they have been entered into by Congress and to discharge as well the debts of the United States as the debts incurred by the several states during the late war for the common defense and general welfare." So in other words, they're to do these things because they're, you know, the this overall, you know, need to fulfill the common defense and general welfare. Quote, "Then to make laws for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by the United States." Now, Mr. Gary considered giving the power only without adopting the obligation as destroying the security now enjoyed by the public creditors of the United States. He enlarged on the merit of this class of citizens and the solemn faith which he had pledged under the existing Confederation. If their situation should be changed as here proposed, great opposition would be excited against the plan. He urged also that as the states, he made different degrees of exertion to sink their respective debts, those who had done most would be alarmed if they were now to be saddled with a share of the debts of states which had done the least. In other words, this idea of assuming the debt by the federal government was just brought up. What Hamilton did with the Assumption Act was actually brought up, and they deliberately avoided it to not happen. And so how did Congress, you know, get convinced to actually overstep this, because it was never enumerated that they could do that? And there you have it. So you can actually see, because it was outside that enumeration, it was literally unconstitutional. But all sorts of things are not enumerated, and they're doing them, and all of them are unconstitutional. Folks, we're doing it. We need your help. As I always say, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.